Over NBC's Coast to Coast network of independent and affiliated stations, the University of Chicago Roundtable. We present Neil Jacoby, Dean of the College of Business Administration of the University of California at Los Angeles. Mr. Jacoby.
Gentlemen, we are discussing this morning the politics of international trade. This presidential election year is a year of decision in American relations with the rest of the world. Every one of us has a stake in the decisions that are going to be made. You, Arthur Coons, as an international economist for 25 years, served as a member of the reparations mission to Japan during 1945 and 46. And you, Latish, as a member of the Department of Economics of the University of California at Berkeley, have just completed a study of the reciprocal trade agreements in the world economy published by the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. I wish to ask you whether the present crisis in Berlin does not demonstrate the enormous importance of international trade. Here, Russia is trying to bring all of Berlin and ultimately all of Western Europe under her heel by blocking the normal movement of food and fuel to the people of a great city. Russia hopes that this blockage of international trade will do what would otherwise require the power of a vast army and air force. Latish, isn't it true that the Iron Curtain drawn by Russia between Eastern and Western Europe is now costing American taxpayers billions of dollars a year?
There's no question, Jacoby, that not only is the deadlock of East-West trade being financed by the American consumer, but the entire success of the Marshall Program or the Economic Administration Act of 1948 is contingent upon the successful resumption of East-West trade.
Could you spell that out a bit?
Surely. Wheat, meat, timber, coal, oil, some of the minerals actually come from the countries now in the Soviet orbit. Now, although no one has yet shown, and it may well be that no one could show, that a practical and mutual satisfactory trading code could be framed for the economic relations between a state trading and free enterprise economy. Yet there is no reason why we could not continue trade on ad hoc arrangements. If we must quarrel with the Russians, there are much more important reasons for doing so than those that arise out of its trade policy and trade measures. If we could only agree reasonably politically, then I think we could work out tolerable trade relations between the Soviet orbit and the rest of the world, even though they may be economically unsatisfactory.
As I see it, we should not cut off our own noses to spite our faces. Our vexation with Russia during the past year has been tremendous, and there have been many people in this country who have argued that we ought to close off all trade with Russia ourselves. But they have forgotten, these people who so argue, that we are drawing from the Russian economy considerable quantities of manganese and chrome and platinum and other critical and strategic raw materials that are important for our own system of defense and of preparation for war. With reference to East-West trade in Europe, and its importance for the progress of Western Europe and for the economy as a whole, it seems to me that we ought to recognize that trade is one item in the development of a free world. Our economic policy is not imperialistic, and it is not developed to create a whole series of dependent states in economic vassalage to us, as Russia tends to create states dependent upon her. But our policy is to strengthen economies in the non-totalitarian world so that they can support more largely their own defense and participate in developing the kind of world that we want to live in. We believe in equality of treatment in trade relations, while as the totalitarian powers develop discriminating systems. We cannot effectively change conditions inside the Iron Curtain, but we can affect, importantly, the balance of the world economy.
Well, then it would appear that both the ultimate success of the Marshall Plan and the solution to the Berlin crisis depend in the end upon the restoration of normal trading arrangements.
As I see it, yes.
Well, coming then to the United States, someone may say international trade is vital to the European countries, which are much smaller in area. But after all, only between 3 and 5% of our gross national production is exported, and a somewhat lesser percentage imported. It's not vital to the United States. Doesn't that overlook some important facts, Latif?
I think that argument is specious, Jacoby. Why don't we examine even the Depression year, such as 33? The United States exported more than 50% of its cotton, 41% of its refined copper, 53% of gum resin, 30 to 40% of its motor trucks and parts, aircraft engines, leaf tobacco, lead, and dried fruits, and up to 30% of its industrial, electrical, and agricultural machinery, iron and steel manufacture, industrial chemicals, office appliances, wheat, oranges, apples, and pears. Perhaps even more important is the fact that we should not consider the relation of our exports, say, to our total production of goods and services, the gross national product, as it's called, but the relation of our trade to the total trade of the world. And in that setting, our exports in 46-47 are close to 30% of total world exports.
From the standpoint of those of us who live in California, the exportation of fresh and dried fruits is very important.
How about also, motion picture films?
Very good. Motion picture films, true. And from the standpoint of those who live in the southern section of the United States, cotton as an export is a vital factor in economic well-being. And let's not forget that certain industries, say, for example, the typewriter industry, have depended upon a very large percentage of exports in certain years. And Latish has already mentioned the automotive field as being important.
Well, now you have mentioned certain United States industries that need foreign markets. But is it not also true that the United States needs from the rest of the world a number of very critical commodities?
Well, you're right. Jacoby, we're not independent in all of those materials that are essential to defense and war. We really are dependent for many essential materials. There was a list prepared a year or two ago by the Army and Navy Munitions Board of 53 items which were suitable for stockpiling. Now, some of the items that were in this list were chromite, ferromanganese, nickel, platinum, tin, industrial diamonds, quartz crystals, asbestos, bismuth, cadmium, copper, lead, mercury, tungsten, zinc, antimony, vanadium, bauxite, mica. And then there are certain industries where we have a partial dependence anyway, such as in petroleum, which is growing, and in arsenic, in the field of iron ores, and fluorspar. And the new world of atomic energy calls to our importance columbite and cobalt and the minerals that yield uranium like carnotite and pitch blende and then also thorium. So that we must maintain a trading system so that these materials can flow toward us.
Well, it's perfectly clear then that the United States cannot live alone and like it if we propose to operate a high-geared industrial economy that makes use of all of the advances in technology. American economic policy, then, I take it, is a cornerstone of world prosperity because our weight in total world trade is so heavy. I'd like to raise this question. What is, overall, American economic policy?
Well, Jacoby, may I suggest that you outline that for us? You were a member of the Research Advisory Board of the Committee on Economic Development, that national group of leading businessmen and corporations. I should think you might well outline that for us.
Well, Coons, the Committee for Economic Development thought hard about the requisites for developing a world trade, and it seemed to us that tariff policy was only one of a number of things that must be examined. It appeared to us that there were six major prerequisites to an expanding world trade, and that the United States is pursuing a conceived and well-integrated policy for implementing all of them. I'd just like to run over them. The first requisite for developing world trade is the emergence of world security, political security.
Jacoby, on that, we led the way in developing the United Nations. Now, although much must be done to make this a more satisfying world security system, it is in accord with our political traditions of developing political agencies by a process of reason and consent. Furthermore, we are now developing our military power to strengthen our capacity to support the United Nations or regional security arrangements that are permitted within the United Nations Charter. So I think we're working on the security angle there.
Correct. The second point that we thought requisite was the steps to maintain high employment and stable prices in the United States.
Well, Jacoby, I think that's really where most of the work has yet to be done. With it passed the Employment Act of 1946. But for the successful implementation of our foreign trade policy, there's no question that the greatest thing that the United States can do is to maintain stable and high levels of income and employment at home. Because the level of our imports and exports are predominantly dependent upon the level of our own domestic production on the one hand and the level of production of our most important buyers on the other.
Correct. The third factor that we thought underlay effective world trade was dependable currencies and stable exchange rates.
Well, I would simply cite the development of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank on this point to show the integrity of American policy.
And a fourth point was that we must work out the problem of trading between private enterprise economies like the American one and state monopolies like those that Russia has.
Now, this is a crucial problem, Jacoby. And as we mentioned previously, as yet a formal solution has not been achieved.
Are we making headway on it, Latiche?
Now, with reference to the International Trade Organization, we did include in the charter provisions whereby trade could be furthered between free enterprise economies and completely state-controlled economies. And if a state-controlled country plays a minor role in world trade, then its trading method is of minor importance. Surely at this point in history, whether or not our trading measures maximize the economic welfare of a country is of secondary importance as compared to whether or not they lead to tension, friction, and quarrels. Now, the Soviet Union in the past was not a major factor in world trade. Say, in 1946, its imports amounted to only 3.2% of total world imports, and its exports to 1.3% of total world exports. If we take all the countries in the Soviet orbit, in 1946, they conducted about 5% of the total world exports, whereas trade with the countries having United States reciprocal trade agreements was close to 80% of world exports. And the same thing is true on the import side.
I take it then you feel that it will be possible to integrate the Soviet economy with a world system of trade predominantly on a free enterprise basis.
Well, I wouldn't put it that way, perhaps, Jacoby, for this reason. That with all deference to Prime Minister Stalin's statements of the possibility of collaboration and all of Pravda's exhortations, we have yet seen no concrete willingness on the part of the USSR to participate in any of the international economic organizations, be it the fund, the bank, or the ITO. Yet, during the interwar period, we did have tolerable trade arrangements with them, and I think on that line, something could be worked out, if we agree politically.
A fifth prerequisite to the establishment of strong world trade is, of course, the economic rehabilitation of Britain and Europe.
Well, we've done a good bit along that line. Perhaps we've done more, when you think of it, than any nation in history has done in the financial and economic assistance to other countries. Look at Lend-Lease, our participation in UNRWA, then there was the British loan and the Marshall Plan. And all of these have contributed in the direction of an overall policy.
And finally, as a prerequisite to international trade, we must have, it seemed to the CED group, a reduction in trade barriers. And here again, we have taken action, have we not?
Yes, Jacoby. Not only have we inaugurated the Reciprocal Trade Agreement Program in 1934, but by 1939, roughly 60% of United States foreign trade was conducted with trade agreement countries. And recently, we have signed the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. 123 agreements among 23 countries, perhaps the most important step forward toward establishing a reasonable pattern of world economic organization.
It appears to me that since the war, the United States has done a splendid thing in pursuing an economic policy in all of its branches for the establishment of stable currencies, economic rehabilitation, the maintenance of employment, and the reduction of its own tariff barriers, which adds up and integrates into a policy for the kind of a free economic order that Americans want to live in. I believe that the splendor and the significance of this policy has not been sufficiently emphasized. What do you say, Coons?
I agree with you. I'm delighted over its general consistency. One aspect of it, however, that we ought not to fail to recognize is that it has to a large degree been bipartisan. Of course, the pressures on the Democrats to support the program through the years has been somewhat greater. That is, their party has been in power in the Roosevelt and Truman administrations. But some of them have wavered, just as a good many Republicans have supported these measures. So it may be that we're in the process of developing the basis for a consistent bipartisan economic policy, paralleling our foreign policy on a bipartisan basis in other areas.
Well, that brings us up to the salient political issues of trade policy today. We have a presidential election coming up in November. What are the issues that the American voters should insist that the candidates discuss and take a clear position upon? It seems to me that there are probably three. First is the administration of the Reciprocal Trade Agreements Act. Secondly, the General Tariff and Trade Agreement made at the Geneva Conference. And third, the question of the ratification by the United States of our adherence to the International Trade Organization. Let's tackle those issues. And we might first of all notice what the two principal parties have said in their platforms. I was reading the Democratic Party platform. It says this: "We pledge ourselves to restore the Reciprocal Trade Agreements program formulated in 1934 by Secretary of State Cordell Hull and operated successfully for 14 years until crippled by the Republican 80th Congress. Further, we strongly endorse our country's adherence to the International Trade Organization." The Republican platform is a little bit more guarded in its wording. Here's what it says: "At all times, safeguarding our own industry and agriculture, and under efficient administrative procedures for the legitimate consideration of domestic needs, we shall support the system of reciprocal trade and encourage international commerce." Batiste, you've made a careful study of the Reciprocal Trade Agreements Act. Has it reduced trade barriers?
Yes, the Reciprocal Trade Agreement Act certainly has reduced trade barriers. For example, just before the war, more than 3,000 concessions had been granted to us, covering approximately 75% of our exports of agricultural products and about 50% of our exports of industrial products. On the average, for the years 38-39, as compared with the years, say, 34-35, total exports to trade agreement countries increased 63%, while exports to non-agreement countries increased only 31.7%. Total agricultural exports during this period remained practically unchanged, but agricultural exports to trade agreement countries, Jacoby, increased by approximately 50%, while agricultural exports to non-agreement countries actually decreased by 26%.
The Trade Agreements Act then clearly did increase markets in foreign countries for American goods.
There's no question at all about that. The concessions were obtained on industrial, electrical, agricultural machinery, aircraft and steel mill products, shipbuilding, pharmaceuticals and automotive products, virtually every significant item in our export trade.
How about the concessions, tariff concessions, that the United States made to other countries?
We imported approximately 879 millions of dutiable imports in 39, and 62% of these imports entered at rates reduced by reciprocal trade agreements. These provided our producers and our consumers with lower priced materials and finished products. More than 1,000 rates were lowered, stimulating such essential imports as steel alloys and non-ferrous metals, imports for which the United States was becoming increasingly dependent on foreign sources of supply. Many of these imports, as Coons pointed out, and their derivatives, tungsten, magnesium, manganese, antimony, are indispensable to our metallurgical industries, which are the core of the industrial structure of our whole economy.
Well, now, in the general tariff and trade agreement that was reached between some 23 countries at Geneva, it is true that the United States accelerated its program of trade barrier reduction through the Reciprocal Trade Agreements Act. What did this General Trade and Tariff Agreement do for our economy, or perhaps, as some critics might put it, to our economy, Coons?
Well, it seems to me that it provided us with the basis for a policy that could work for a broad, expanding world trading system. It said that if we are going to lead the way in world trade, we have to repudiate the doctrine of restrictive tariffs and barriers on trade. If we should lead the way in the opposite direction toward restriction or do little to help pull down the trade walls over the world, we ourselves would be in the process of promoting economic isolation. And the nations would all be searching for economic self-sufficiency, which, after all, is the counsel of fear and of desperation. And this would lead to economic warfare. And that would mean less goods for all around. So this policy that we supported at Geneva indicated that we believed we should strive for economic cooperation in creating a broadly competitive economic internationalism by reestablishing and developing the world trading system. That's how it fits into the overall economic policy of the United States.
But let's look at what the critics say. They say that low-cost foreign goods will hurt American industry, take away their markets. Is there any substance to that claim?
Well, why don't we look at the facts, Jacoby? What are the wages in protected industries, say domestic industries and export industries? Actually, weekly earnings, 1939, as I think they are today, in protected industries, such as carpets and rugs, pottery, silks and rayon, cotton goods, were lowest. In domestic industries, such as printing and publishing, say, street railroads and buses, private building and construction, they were a little higher. And actually, in the export industries, such as automobiles, machine tools, agricultural implements, they were highest on the list. Yet, there is one danger. We should never use bad arguments for good causes. Say, if a country like India does have low money wages, and they can import machinery from the United States, know-how, they perhaps could produce steel and compete with U.S. exports. But the record suggests that as long as a multinational trading system works, our best customers are actually countries with the highest standard of living. And right through the period, those countries industrialized most were our best customers.
There's another point that I think needs to be made. We're going through a period of price inflation here at home, a shortage of goods and an excess of demand. The entry into this country of foreign wares would help us combat price inflation and help to lead to American economic stability.
The logic of our international economic position is that of demanding an increase of imports over the years that lie ahead. The logic of our internal economic situation calls also for the development of imports. We must readjust ourselves to the requirements of this day in the development of the American economy.
Well, now there's a third great political issue that faces us in this election year. Should the International Trade Organization and American membership in it be ratified by Congress? What does the ITO, to shorten its name, do, Latiche?
Well, I think there's no question at all that the ITO probably has greater significance in the political arena today than it even has in the economic.
What
predominantly
do you mean?
Because smaller countries, through a trading program of this kind, don't have to become appendages to any political power. They can develop economically and politically along lines of their own choosing. Now, to many of these countries, the freedom of choice no longer exists. Everything that the United States government can do to retain that freedom of choice means the preservation of our form of economic organization and, I think, the preservation of Western civilization as such.
Well, just as the International Monetary Fund was an arrangement whereby countries agreed not to devalue their currencies without the consent of an international authority, so the International Trade Organization would take over some of the powers that nations now exercise to prevent them from being exercised to hurt other countries. It's said, Coons, that this is an instrumentality of world planning and that it has delivered control over our foreign policy to an international body.
I don't believe that's true. I believe it's helping to establish the framework within which private free enterprise can live. And unless we find the ways whereby there may be an increase of trade all around, and this is one of the mechanisms, we may see the collapse of the system of free enterprise that we have known.
Yet, there are dangers here. One of the worst things the United States government could do is to offer its leadership to the rest of the world in a form that would appear as if we're trying to impose it upon them. And the dangers, such as hidden dumping, the reconciling of our cultural and our trade policies, are crucial. And although no country has ever been able to refrain from mixing its principles, we must retain some degree of consistency in our general policy.
Yes, it is perfectly clear that if international trade is to be rescued from the disorganization and chaos that now exists, with any country free to slap on duties at any rate, at any time, or to dump its products into another country, or to impose exchange restrictions, that the rebirth and growth of world trade would be impossible. The rules of the game should be established, and they should be established by an international authority and not by nations individually. Well, I'd like to ask, gentlemen, how you would summarize the discussion that we have had here today of the politics of world trade. Coons?
I would say that the large importance of the United States foreign trade in world trade, which regretfully many Americans do not realize, underlines the mutual dependence of this country and all other countries, particularly those outside the Soviet orbit. We need markets and they need markets. Our industrial and economic production is 40% of world production. All right, if they go down, we suffer. If they improve, we gain. Also, their economic welfare depends vitally on what the volume and stability of American economic activity is. As I see it, America's commercial and economic policy, both domestic and foreign, overall is fundamental to world prosperity and is one of the cornerstones, really, of world peace.
I think that's good, Coons. It seems to me that compared to the interwar period, the new reciprocal trade agreements and the Havana Charter are well designed to provide a code and institutions appropriate to international economic order under which men can live in peace and well-being. Yet, I think that it must be Europe that does the big job of restoring the European economy. And if the passage to free multilateral trade is to be seriously worked, foreign countries will have to, one, control the domestic inflations, abolish the black markets, reduce their excessive subsidized consumption, cut down their inflated building and investment programs, which the resource structures unfortunately cannot support, provide greater production incentives by gradually moving toward a freer market economy, expand the trade relations among one another along multilateral lines. Yet, to establish the institutional pattern in which this can be done, the greatest responsibility probably rests with us.
I agree.
And that, I think, we must, one, reconcile agricultural and foreign trade policies, abolish our own bilateral and tie-in loans, thereby permitting foreign countries to use the dollars wherever they may wish, initiate multilateral action on transportation subsidies, and the removal of discriminatory legislation on ocean shipping, the implementation of domestic policy to check inflation, and the development of institutions which would help provide a high and stable flow of United States dollars and would thereby check the perverse tendency of any possibility of exporting unemployment.
Thank you, gentlemen. You've been listening to the University of Chicago Roundtable discuss the politics of international trade, the second in a series of roundtable programs on economic issues in this presidential election year. Participants in today's discussion were Neil Jacoby, Dean of the College of Business Administration of the University of California at Los Angeles, Arthur Coons, President of Occidental College, and J.M. Latiche of the Department of Economics of the University of California at Berkeley. This week's roundtable pamphlet includes the full text of today's discussion and a special article on the Geneva and Havana World Trade Conferences. A copy of this pamphlet, including the important article, costs only 10 cents in coin. Send 10 cents with your order to the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois. Today's roundtable came to you from Hollywood. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.